Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong, and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. Today, we are continuing into our second season of Halloween is Canceled. So this is the occasional Development Hell mini-series where we unearth unmade Halloween films all October long. And we're right in the middle of it. Episode 3. Today, we're going to be signing into Smith's Grove Sanitarium to reveal Halloween Asylum. But we're also going to be talking about all things Halloween 9, the never-made follow-up to Halloween Resurrection. And I know, yes, I say this every week, but today we are truly joined by a very special guest, Nick Phillips. Nick is a former development executive for Dimension Films and one of the shadowy overlords who was actually in charge of developing Michael Myers films. Nick, how's it going?
Josh, how are you, man? I'm so excited to be here. I think that's the first time I've ever been referred to as a shadowy overlord, and I like it. I think it fits. If people still had business cards, I'd put that on there for sure. But no, thank you for having me, Josh. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm a really big fan of the podcast. Super psyched to dive into these unrealized sequels with you.
Can you introduce yourself? Like, who are you? What's your childhood trauma? Like, what's your whole deal?
Oh, gosh. Do you have that long on this podcast? No.
Yeah.
My name is Nick Phillips, primarily a producer, also a writer-director at times, but mainly a producer. Been in the business almost 30 years. I was a studio executive for 15 of those years, 9 years at Dimension Films, as you have previously mentioned, 6 years at Sony Screen Gems. I co-ran a genre label called Revolver Picture Company for about 5 years. I was a freelance producer and a producer for hire for many years. I was head of production at two small companies in the last few years, one called Creator Plus, one called Yale Entertainment. At the moment, I'm actually starting a new genre label with some noteworthy friends, so we can talk about that on future podcasts, but that is sort of in its nascency right now. I'm super excited about it, be able to talk more about it coming months. But yeah, that's my long history. And I think my childhood drama is watching too many scary movies, watching too many slasher movies in my early teens, I think.
Oh my God, you and me both. And we're going to get to know Nick pretty well in just a second. But as I said, we are going to unpack all things Unmade Halloween 9 in its various forms. But we are going to focus specifically on the script Halloween Asylum by writer Matt Vane.
Yep.
So starting with you, Nick, how did you become a horror fan? Where did that all sort of start?
As previously mentioned, I'm not kidding. I watched horror films at an obnoxiously young age. And I don't know if that was my late parents' fault or not. I don't know if they were even paying attention, but I had two brothers. I have two brothers still. I'm the middle. And, you know, I grew up, I talk about this, by the way, there's a book of essays called My Favorite Horror Movie, which I guess I'm inadvertently plugging. If you read that, if you ever read that, you'll hear me regurgitate a little bit of that. But I grew up in the era of VHS, right? And so the local video store is called Errol's Video, A-R-O-L-S, Errol's Video. And they had like a 4-movie limit, right? You can rent 4 movies at a time. So me and my brothers would go into the horror section, beeline for the horror section, look for the craziest, goriest box, right? Because all those the box art in those days was amazing. And the crazier, the better. We'd rent 4 movies at a time, whatever it was. And you and I talked about this a little bit beforehand, too. Everything from old Universal classics, you know, The Wolfman, Frankenstein, Dracula, all the way up to, you know, what was then current in the 80s being slasher films. We'd rent everything, the 70s classics, Hammer movies from the 60s, just everything we could get our hands on. And we just fed ourselves a steady diet of horror films. And I guess I'm admitting to a crime here, but we would record them. I own 2 VHSs. We were lucky enough to own 2 VHS machines, and we would record those movies. You could fit 2 on a VHS tape. So we'd do 2 movies at a time. Sometimes I'd record one while we slept. So it was just this little factory of, recording horror films for constant ingestion. And really the ones that stood out for my childhood, of course, were like the Carpenter thing. Mm-hmm. Was a movie that my brothers and I just were horrified by. Jaws, I saw at a very young age. Alien, I was about 7 when I saw that movie.
Damn.
That's that era. And that's that kind. And of course, Friday 13th, Halloween, like that's really was that formative era for me and the kinds of movies I watched. So I became a horror fan just by simply just watching them near constantly, not even during Halloween season, but year round. And I also was lucky enough to have a camera, one of those old home video cameras that was so big, it would rest on your shoulder and it would take like 1/2-inch tapes. Like VHS tapes. And I'd make little slasher movies with my younger brother. My older brother, I think, was too cool and old at that point. But my younger brother and I would make little slasher movies. Just ever since I can remember, I've loved the genre and just always kind of wanted to get into it however I could, as a filmmaker or what have you.
So you have, in fact, produced for some of the most iconic horror franchises out there. How did you sort of start in the world of producing and developing?
I moved to Los Angeles for a brief period in 1996. I worked at an agency. I was an agent assistant, but I didn't want to be an agent. And some friends in New York, I'd gone to college in New York, and some friends of mine said, hey, you know, one of our roommates is moving out. Why don't you move back to New York? So I like just dropped everything and moved back to New York because I really missed it at that time. Moved to New York, and you'll love this, Josh. There really was no internet. So there was this book called The Hollywood Creative Directory, this giant book.
Whoa.
And it had like the address and, you know, contact name and like fax number for every production company in LA and New York. So I would just go to the New York section and I'd come home at night. I was bartending and like doing odd jobs, and I would come home at night and fax. I would tailor a cover letter for whatever company I was sending it to, fax my resume out like 10 a night. And one day Miramax called me and I became a receptionist at Miramax Film in their New York office. One of their like satellite buildings. It wasn't even like in the main hub, but still. Mm-hmm. Met a lot of great people. There was 2 attorneys that worked on that floor. They hired me to be their assistant in business affairs for a year. And that taught me a lot about how to read contracts, how to, you know, with their permission, I would listen to their phone calls and sit in on meetings and just you learn how to structure deals and how to read contracts and just legal ease. Whoa. Right. So, but I obviously wasn't going to get promoted to become an attorney. So there was a bit of a ceiling on that job, but it taught me a lot about, you know, deal making and how things were structured. And then a friend of mine on the Dimension side, because Miramax and Dimension are sister, you know, brother and sister companies.
Mm-hmm.
A guy I knew on the Dimension side he said, hey, I'm leaving the company. Do you want to come be the assistant to these 2 dudes? Their names are Andrew Rona and Richard Potter. And they were the SVPs of Dimension at the time. He said, do you want to be their assistant? And I interviewed with them. And it's funny, in the interview, they kind of say, and like not in a nefarious way, they say, hey, are you like a Dimension person or a Miramax person? Because Miramax was known known for making these really great like period pieces and Oscar movies and all that stuff. But Dimension was making, Dimension was making the down the and dirty stuff. Genre movies that made a lot of money. So I was like, yeah, I'm a Dimension person. And I wasn't just saying it to get. So yeah, I started as an assistant in 1998 at Dimension. I became an executive in 2000. I moved out to California in 2003 and worked in their LA office for 2 years. So I was at the company and left in 2005 to go to Sony here in LA. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so I was there for 8 years. And you know, once I got into Dimension, it was all genre all the time. Working on, I wouldn't say work, you know, as an assistant, you got to give notes. So I was giving notes on things like Scream 3 and H2O and, you know, just kind of starting out in like the Dracula 2000 movies. And
here we go.
Anyway, we can get into all that. But yes, that's how I started. I just faxed my resume and started started as an entry level, at an entry level position, and found my way forward.
When we first started talking, I was not fully aware of your resume, and I quickly found out that you, in fact, have produced some of my favorites.
Yes.
So I want to talk a little bit about the different franchises you've been involved with before we headed to Halloween. I know that Hellraiser is a big one of them. I know that Dracula 2000 is another. Which of the landmark horror sort of canons have you been involved with?
Well, first of all, yes, Josh, I was listening to the episode where you and you had a couple of great guests on. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting their
name. Kim and Kat.
They were awesome. Yes, sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Kim and Kat.
Hey,
they were great. And you guys were talking about the Michael Myers versus Pinhead unrealized movie, which I have a story about for later. But Josh, you said you loved the movie Hellworld. I was driving.
Yeah.
I said, out loud, I was alone in my car. I said, I knew it. I knew there was one person out there that liked that movie.
Hell yeah.
So I liked you right away, even before we started talking. I said, this guy's great. He loved, you know, he liked Hellworld. yes, I worked on the Hellraiser franchise. So again, to give you some context, in that early, and you know this, we spoke about this a little bit too, in that early 2000s period, it was like the straight to DVD boom, right? Like the DVD market was thriving. It was a great way for studios to enhance their bottom line. It was just a great ancillary revenue stream. So they made, everybody was making direct-to-video sequels. So I was about, I don't even know, maybe 26 at the time. And the higher ups at Dimension said, hey, we're going to make direct-to-video sequels to like all of our franchises, you know, and who wants to be in charge of that? And I don't know if I was the first to raise my hand. I think some of the folks working there at the time were a little older than me, and they had family, maybe they were, you know, the age I am now, and they had families, but they didn't want to spend years in Romania. But I was like, oh, I'll do it. Because we shot them all in Bucharest in Romania. So yeah, we did two sequels to Dracula 2000 called, imaginatively titled Dracula 2 and 3. Did Mimic Sentinel, the third Mimic movie. Did two Hellraiser movies and did two more Prophecy films. So for me, that was
Prophecy.
A great... Yeah, this is all when I was still in my 20s. So it was a great way just to learn, right? To really understand the production process and development. Like we would just come up with ideas for these sequels out of thin air because the higher ups would just go, hey, go do another blah, blah, blah movie. And you'd have to sit there and go, okay, well, what can we do? So yeah, it was just a great way to learn how to develop movies and then how to go make them and be on set and figure out how to do it in a foreign country. And yeah, so my first, however many, 10 movies, if it had a colon in it or a number or a subtitle, I was your guy, you know, it was always
nice.
Any kind of sequel or, you know, like the subtitles is always that fun part too. Let's call it Resurrection or Legacy or, you know, all those commonly used subtitles.
Those are my favorites.
Yes, I really learned quite a bit and did a lot of those direct-to-video sequels in the 2000s for Dimension. Yeah, so yeah, quite a few.
Yeah, anyone that listens to this podcast knows that I am an apologist for early 2000s direct-to-video sequel. And I do think Hellraiser Hellworld kind of symbolizes that really at its core. So it's an honor to have you here today.
I appreciate that. I do. That's a whole nother episode, but Hellraiser Deader and Hellraiser Hellworld were shot back to back. We prepped them at the same time, but we shot them in, you know, one movie and then another. We had about a week in between the two movies. So, you know, and neither one of them were based on, both of them were made from other ideas that were then kind of admittedly like shoehorned into the Hellraiser mythology. But those ones were crazy to make, and so I really do appreciate you taking the time
Listen,
to be nice and say you like those movies.
No, you know it's
not
true.
A lot of people do
because they don't respect camp, and I do, and that is why those movies are so especially
funny,
precious.
Though, and I know some filmmakers claim they knew at the time they were making camp. I'm going to break that tradition and tell you we didn't think we were making camp. You
of
know,
course, that's why it's camp.
We were making a straightforward movie, right? And then suddenly you watch, you're like, holy shit, this is campy as hell. And
yes.
You're like, yeah, of course we meant to make it campy, but we did not. I'll tell you right away.
Pinhead with a big cleaver? That's camp. Oh, and I'm so grateful for it. I think I told you this offline, but I saw someone with a t-shirt recently, Hell World t-shirt, and I've never been more jealous of anyone in my life.
That, like, the Matrix-y green numbers and
evil
Pinhead,
goes online.
Evil goes online, man. You know, we saw that one shoot. We were like, all right. I mean, that's about what it is, right?
It goes,
the funny tagline, you know, the great tagline and the quasi-Matrix graphics. That's all you need.
God. So thank you for your service. Now that we've sort of discussed the other pinpoints, and I have to say I'm also a big fan of those Dracula sequels. I think Ascension and Legacy. I could be getting
Ascension
that wrong.
Ascension and Legacy.
Those
hold
are cool as hell.
A special place in my heart. Those were two of the first movies I really oversaw as an executive. And learned a ton, worked with some great filmmakers on those movies and just learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I did mention to you on our first conversation that a lot of those sequels, we would just use other movies as concepts and just kind of, I wouldn't say rip them off.
Hell yeah.
But so I told you that Dracula Legacy, Dracula 3 was sort of basically Apocalypse Now with Dracula. And then Mimic 3 was just Rear Window with cockroaches. You see what I mean? Like, we would just take
this is
concepts of much, much better movies and just say, hey, let's do Rear Window with cockroaches. Or, you know, again, let's do Apocalypse Now with Dracula. So we were just kind of figuring it out as we went along. But again, it was really a big learning process for me. And those movies really are special to me. So truly, thank you for watching them.
Those ones are not camp. Those are like,
I think pretty
people don't know, like, they're good. So if anyone has not seen them, I think people are turned off whenever they hear Dracula 2000. I think it's the fact
campy.
That the,
I mean, that just alone.
That movie's camp as fuck, and I love it.
But just
the
title
other two
is
know.
So campy.
Oh my god! I mean, and I'm a fan, and it stars like millennium pop star Vitamin C. So
the first one, Dracula 2000, Vitamin C. And then we had a really fun like repertory company of actors on all those. Direct-to-video, like some would come back, like Lance Henriksen was in a couple.
Mm-hmm.
Kari Payton, who's in Walking Dead, was in a couple. Jason London, Jason Scott Lee, who else? Kari Wuhr was in a few. It was great. Like, there was actors that would just kind of come back and you know, be in a Dracula movie, and then come back a month later and do a Hellraiser movie. It was cool. It was just really fun, you know.
Yeah, I miss that era so much. I miss the DVD era, but maybe one day we'll find ourselves in something similar. So now we found ourselves getting closer to Haddonfield, I think.
Indeed.
You have worked in the world of Michael Myers a couple of times, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you was Dimension... No, sorry. Was H2O the first time that you sort of were hands-on with a Halloween film?
Yeah, and again, at that point, I was still an assistant, so my involvement was, you know, basically more on the development end. You know, you'd get a draft and everybody would call together their notes, and some were implemented, most were not. But just to be able to see like Kevin Williamson's treatment come in, and everybody was immediately like in jet set it and read it, and we're like, oh my god, this is so cool to read Kevin's take on a Halloween sequel. So yeah, it just, again, it was not super hands-on, involved in very tangential levels, very young and sort of lower on the hierarchy at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, just to kind of even be on like the sidelines and see the new drafts come in, and to be around for, you know, I would sit near the casting person's office, so you hear about who they're going out to, who they're getting, and I thought that was really fun. It was one of the, I don't know if it was one of the first, but again, it was one of the, it seemed like one of the first movies to kind of retcon things in the sense that like other sequels just didn't happen, right?
Yep.
Like the idea with H2O was it's a sequel to Halloween and Halloween 2, right? After the hospital movie in 81, this movie was a direct, they forgot about the Thorne trilogy, yada, yada, yada. So it was cool to kind of not be a part of, but to hear those decisions being made and to kind of be in the room for some of the stuff was awesome. And just as a childhood fan, to just be around a Halloween movie was amazing. Yes.
I've got to say H2O, I know everyone has a different opinion, but I think it's probably the greatest Halloween sequel there is. So
I thought it was really good. I was really pleased with it. Not you know, I think we all were, but like, you know, it was like the original in the sense that there's not a huge body count, right? And it's not super gory. I know Joseph Gordon-Levitt gets a ice skate in his face at the beginning, but it's really not You know, and there's some low points, the CGI version of the Myers mask and that a couple shots. There's some definitely some low points. But no, I thought it was solidly made. Again, it was one of the first movies that was made when I was at Dimension. So I was like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah.
Great. But yes, I thought it was a good sequel. Yeah.
And unlike most people on this planet, I have no apologies to be made for Halloween Resurrection either.
Nor do I. That's pure camp, in my opinion. I really am not throwing anybody on the bus. So I'm not saying, hey, but I didn't. I really did not. That's when I was doing a lot of those sequels in Romania. I just wasn't. I know it totally sounds like I'm trying to skirt that movie, but I wasn't. I was not around. And I, the folks that did work on it, I'm not at all impugning them. I just wasn't involved in that. You know, again, as a team or as a company, we would become more involved. Like for test screenings, you know, maybe you give a note, like you'd go to the test screening as a company and you'd hear the audience reaction or see the audience reaction as the movie's playing and then hear their comments in the focus group afterwards. So, but no, really was not super involved in that movie. And I don't know, maybe that was, I don't know, but I was then assigned Halloween 9. So I don't know if that was because I don't know. Right. So maybe somebody went, let's get this dude to do it. He had nothing, you know,
new blood.
He's been in Romania for like a year, so maybe, again, I don't know. I'm utterly speculating, and I am not at all trying to speak ill of the folks who did work on Resurrection. So, just to be clear.
Listen, everyone knows that this podcast is pro-Resurrection, but to my understanding, yeah, that's when they brought you on board to sort of really get involved with the development of the next sequel. So, we'll call it Halloween 9. So, what was the start of that journey? How did that begin?
It really was just that simple where you get a call from, you know, somebody up the ladder and they say, hey, man, you know, you got to go hear pitches and try to figure out what the next Halloween movie is going to be. And I'm like, OK, so you just start calling agents and managers and you say, hey, send me a writing sample of somebody who would be great for them. And so it's a combo. So you go out to agents and managers, you get a bunch of samples, you read them and you go, oh, this person would be good or that person would be good or. And Matt Vane was on this list. You have a short list of people that you like working with already that the company likes working with. So again, you go out to some of the go-to people, you read a bunch. I mean, you read a ton of samples and a couple of them might jump out at you and you go, okay, excuse me, the person that wrote this movie, let's have them give a pitch or, hey, you know, and so you just start hearing pitches, dozens and dozens, whether they're verbal, whether they come in and pitch you the movie in the room or whether somebody sends you a treatment. We just started getting in a bunch of stuff. And it's funny, and we don't have to jump in yet, but reading these scripts for these unmade sequels was like seeing an old friend. It was just so funny, like reading these. And it was really apparent, you know, it kind of jarred my memory a lot. It really shows, and you probably would concur, clearly the mandates were like, Freddie Harris has to come back. It has to be something to do with Smith. I do remember all this now where we really wanted to focus on Smith's Grove. That seemed like a logical place to go. And at some or all of the legacy characters should come back. Right. I mean, we'll get in more of that in the details, but it really seemed like the more pitches we heard, the more we refined it to be like, all right, those should be the kind of boxes that need to be checked. Smith's Grove, legacy characters, and a returning character from either H2O or Resurrection or both, right? So
fascinating.
But again, I mentioned this to you the first time we spoke. I wish I still had it. There is a Word document somewhere, somehow, with the log line of every pitch that I heard over however many months. Again, the bosses at the time were like, hey, you know, where are we on this? We need to see, I want to see a huge, you know, layout of the log line for every pitch you've heard. So I wrote it up and, God, I wish I still had it because I honestly want to say there was like 50 to 60 pitches.
Oh, damn.
And again, at range, it wasn't like I was sitting there 50 or 60 times hearing somebody give me an hour-long pitch. Some of them, again, were just treatments or whatever. But yeah, we heard a lot. And it ranged from, of course, there's one in space. You're not going to do a ninth movie if you and not hear a pitch for the antagonist or the villain not going into space. There was one set at like an amusement park, kind of like what Hellfest, you know, something like what eventually happened with Hellfest.
Yeah.
He was on like a ship, this big experimental ship out to sea. And they were trying to like, the military was like trying to harness his evil to make like super soldiers, just things like that. Like we just heard a bunch. a bunch of stuff like that, you know?
People are nuts. Didn't you say the amusement park one had like a real wild title?
Abusement park.
Like Halloween abusement
Halloween
park?
Halloween colon abusement, which is just, again, shocking. I'm not trying to impugn anybody. So that person
I love
listening,
it.
But it's just like, it's a cruel title. Yeah, it's just dark. It's just a mean title, man. I just can't see that on a poster. And I can't see, hey, let's go see abusement park. It just sounds mean. It sounds
insane. And, you know, and we're complaining about Resurrection. Just imagine alternative history of fans.
But if that had come out. So, but keep in mind, and I'll say this, and again, once we get into the details of Asylum, like, you know, Freddie Harris coming back in some of these drafts was not an accident, or that was not a decision made in a vacuum. I know there's a lot to be said about Resurrection, but at the test screenings, that character tested extraordinarily high. Like, audiences loved Freddie Harris.
Loved him. Yeah.
And you know, highly rated in all the focus groups, and you ask people and you look at the cards after the research screening, like, wow, everybody loves Freddie, to the point where they added new scenes and we went and reshot stuff. To add Freddy into the movie more. I think that scene in the hotel where he's watching the Kung Fu movie and it was all new. And
oh my God, I love that.
So again, and I know there's a lot to say about Resurrection, but again, like, bringing him back felt like a logical thing because audiences loved him. So again, that wasn't just like, whatever, we'll bring Freddy back. It was pretty conscious.
That gives me an idea. So I'm assuming you heard that Miramax won the TV rights to Halloween recently.
I sure did.
Okay, so now we have I have a perfect pitch for them. It's greenlit already. Dangertainment. That's the name of the series.
Yep. Because if it's a connected TV universe, you can do things like
you
that.
You can
like,
do that.
A whole Dangertainment series.
A
you
whole
know?
Dangertainment series. 8 seasons. Get Busta back.
Yeah, Busta's, you know, he's still around.
He's
and,
alive.
You know, he's charismatic and, you know, all that. So, yeah, If I was making the decision, Josh, I would stamp that. Yeah, rubber stamp.
I think we have something on our hands here. But you know what? Never mind about the future of Halloween. We're still in its past, and
yes,
we're about to dive real deep into Halloween Asylum. So this is one of these unmade Halloween 9 pitches that, you know, luckily we got the script for, thanks to you. So we got to take a full dive into this whole story, which is, you know what, like a horror nerd fan come true. And I'm really excited to dig into it. Before we start, let's talk a little bit about the writer. We're talking about Halloween Asylum, written by Matt Vane. People may remember his name from, well, he's written episodes of Masters of Horror, Fear Itself, Creepshow, and also films like The Exorcist of Molly Hartley, White Noise 2, and Acts of Vengeance. Were you friends with him? Like, what was your connection with Matt?
Yeah, friendly, meaning like there was just a small handful of writers that I and other folks at Dimension knew or worked with. So no, I would, you know, and I'm not saying this, I'm saying this in a good way. I was friendly. Like, I wish I was better friends with him, but I can't say that we were like super tight friends or anything. So yeah, friendly. Worked on a couple other things, or at least, you know, had him pitch on a few other things, and they'd always send me, you know, his latest spec or whatever. And it was always that kind of thing where you kind of circled each other looking for ways to work together. I was very good friends with his agents, who I'm actually still friends with. I saw one of them recently at a show by the band Ghost, like 3 weeks ago.
Hell yeah.
I saw one of his agents. So he just was always around, Matt, and just a solid, as you meant, he has great credits, as you just listed. So he was always just this guy that, you know, we were just looking for ways to work together. So any open writing assignment that came my way, Matt, as I mentioned earlier, Matt was one of those like shortlist people where you go, oh, let's give it to Matt, you know, and see what he can come up with. So yeah, he's was always around and delivering good work. And, you know, I was excited to kind of go a little bit farther on this one, not go the distance because it didn't get made, but like, yeah, go down the road with him a little bit on this one. And it was, again, really interesting to read these scripts. It was like an old, I don't know, like an old comfortable blanket or something. I you already used the old friend metaphor. But yeah, it was really interesting. I hadn't read these scripts in a couple decades, right? So it was a really cool experience to open these up and really dive back in.
And it's fun. It's like getting to watch a new Halloween movie that I haven't seen.
It kind of was, right? That's a great way to put it. It really was like, oh, Because there's been so many, you know, there's been others since, right? So you're like, oh, this is sort of like, what if, right? Because you've seen where other people have taken it with the recent trilogy and all that. And you're like, oh, you kind of picture in your head and you go, yeah, it's like a new Halloween movie. That's a great way to think about
this. This would have been 90 times better than Ends. Okay. So I attempted a bit of a premise, like putting a premise for this together. Yep. Can I give it a try? And you can tell me what you think.
Yes.
All right. So Halloween Asylum. After the events of Resurrection, Michael Myers finds Freddy Danger and murders him at a seedy motel. This is where he is caught by the feds and taken to Smith's Grove. A few years later, the night of his scheduled execution, the hospital's power falters, allowing Michael and the other residents to unleash. But we have a new character, a Dr. Loomis type, Dr. Crane, and he is ready because he remembers what happened in 78. So the second shit goes down, he locks down the hospital, sort of like what we saw in House on Haunted Hill. So this traps all of our lead characters, as well as a camera crew, in the asylum with Michael Myers and a number of other highly dangerous psychopaths. We also see the return of Sheriff Brackett in a bit of a tragic B-plot. And there is a bunch of violence. Okay, how did I do?
Dude, could not have said it better myself. That was summarized like a true professional. Really.
Oh,
that was,
wow.
I mean, that's... Good night, everybody. I'm the podcast. No, I'm kidding. No, it was great. I mean, it really is. That was a great summation of it. And it kind of speaks to the contained high concept of it all, which I will get into in a moment in talking about the script. But yeah, perfectly summarized, buddy.
So this opening kill... We've bringing Freddy Danger back just to get rid of him. Can you tell us a little bit about what this sort of opening scene was like? What's the vibe here?
Okay, so two things. One, and by the way, this is a weird thing to say. It's like spoiler alert, but for a movie that never got made, never will be made. So they do the same kind of fake out that they did at the beginning of Resurrection, right? Where like they explain to you how Michael got out of the burning garage at the end of Resurrection, and it's a body swap like the last one. So whatever. The idea with Freddy killing Freddy so early was A, it's like in that Drew Barrymore mold and Scream. B, it's like Jamie Lee in Resurrection, right? There's obviously precedent for that. I mean, even going back to like Adrian King being killed in the first 10 minutes of Friday 13 too, right? Like there was that's a thing. So I think it allowed us to thread that needle where you have Busta in the movie, you have Freddy in the movie. But it wasn't as much of a time commitment for him because he was really busy at the time. So it's like, yeah, you get him in the movie. He's got a great sequence. It's a fun death. It's a fun kill. Great cat and mouse kind of thing where there's all those other Myers masks and stuff in his room and, you know, cool visuals. You get to use him on the poster. But again, you only need him for like maybe a week or something, right? That's all he had. So it's a way to kind of bridge it to the previous movie. And then a fun kind of reversal to go, oh, the guy we think is our hero is not. Oh, my God. You know, and then you switch to your new protagonist. So it just was in keeping. The idea was basically just in keeping with that time-honored tradition of offing the previous survivor in the first 10 minutes of the subsequent movie.
But because it's not Laurie Strode, I feel like it's more fun. You know, I feel like it's a little more permittable.
And clearly, Laurie Strode's death in the previous movie was like 100 times more significant. You know, I mean, Freddie again was a popular character from the previous one. So I was like, yeah, let's bring back Freddie and give him this spectacular death and you know, see if he's up for it.
And he has fun with it too. Like Michael sort of pins him, I think, to a wall with a knife and he knows, or with something, and he knows he's going to die. So he spits blood in Michael Myers' face.
Yeah.
Says, fuck you, and dies.
Yeah. And I have a little list here. I took notes. Your nice notes, by the way, you sent me notes earlier, are really similar. So, and I'll get to all these. There's so many callbacks in the script, and the first one is that, like pinning Freddy to the wall and Michael doing the head tilt, right?
Oh,
like in the first one with Paul in the kitchen. I think it's Paul in the kitchen in the original one. So, yeah, that was the first callback right away within the first, whatever that was, 10 pages.
Yep.
You go, okay, nice. There we go. Like Matt definitely, and again, there's a lot more that I'll list, but yeah, Matt definitely honors the script in those little Easter eggy ways. So, yes. Yeah, so the first... Right off the bat, you get Freddy coming back, and then he's summarily dispatched.
But you know what? We're having a good time. Maybe I didn't read it closely enough. Was he set up, do you think, by, like, the cops? Like, was he, like, bait so they could trap him, or was that just luck?
I did not read that. I mean,
okay, maybe. Okay, I made
no,
made
to
up.
My knowledge, no, but I did not get that off the page, but that's funny. I did not.
But they found him. they got
that's
him.
An interesting inference. Yeah, that's cool. No, not to my knowledge, no.
Well, and then they do something that I find always semi-hilarious in these franchise films, is then we put him on trial. So then Michael Myers goes on trial for the opening credits, which I love and is nuts whenever they do it, because they did it with Freddy on the TV show, I think, at one point too. And they were going to do it with Jason in a movie, which I think would have been hilarious.
Yeah.
So tell us about these opening credits. What do we see?
So at the time that the first treatments and stuff came in for this movie, we were shooting Feast, the Project Greenlight movie. So I'm sitting there on set, and I was just reminded of this by Patrick Melton, who him and Marcus Dunson have been on your podcast. But I was reading, they were sort of, you know, asking me how the treatment is. And I mentioned that Jason goes on trial. So we kind of started doing this whole thing, you know, like the Southern lawyer. And say, you know, Mr. Myers, did you or did you not kill me? You know, I remind you, sir, you are under oath. You know, like we were, because all I said to them was Michael Myers on trial. And we started riffing on this like horrible, bad version of that. Because it just sounds, you're right, on paper and out loud, it sounds insipid, right? To have this trial scene. I mean, at the very least, he's not in the courtroom, right? That I forgot. When I read it, I'm like, oh, right.
Oh, he's not?
Yeah, there's a little line in there. Oh. It's like, he's not, he doesn't appear in the courtroom because he's too dangerous. So he's like,
I want him in the courtroom with his mask.
Yeah, he's like in absentia or whatever, right?
So okay.
He's not there. Because, yeah, that's like, you know, Mr. Myers, I am talking to you, sir. You are under oath, you know? We just had these horrible versions of it that we would act out on the feast set. So
I'm disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, it just was a way to have a credit sequence.
I love
again,
it.
In H2O, they established this kind of new thing where you can have this visual,
yes.
Right? Whereas obviously in the previous films, it was the classic, you know, pumpkin opening or whatever, you know, the pumpkin.
Yeah.
And, you know, you
and
saw
also like 10 minutes of the previous film.
And they did that in Friday the 13th, but I always loved the old Hollywood where you see Mustafa Akkad's name in big orange letters. Just like gives me the chills. I saw it last night. I watched Halloween 2 last night, the original. But yeah, so the courtroom was just more or less like as a credit sequence thing and you know, I don't know what. I mean, shows you the gears of justice turning to incarcerate Michael and, you know, hold him accountable or what have you. So, yeah, it just was a sort of a visual bridge to make some time pass until you get to him being executed the night of his execution.
And I think, you know, what luck, you know, what coincidence he ends up being incarcerated once again at Smith's Grove. Why not? That's great.
It's his home away from home.
And this is a hospital that also executes people. So this is all working out really, really well.
You caught on to a funny detail. Because I remember I was reading it this weekend. And I was like, what the hell? Mental hospital execute as an electric chair. What the
This
fuck?
One does, babe. And that's great. Good for them. They know what they're doing.
Fully equipped mental hospital. Yeah.
Fully equipped. So I want to talk about our new final girl, Lucy. She's described as pretty, but in a quiet way, which, you know,
don't you love how dudes write women
to bring it up?
I don't know how many scripts I've read in my career. I've read so many, and again, I'm not impugning anybody. I'm just having some fun at some of these. It's always
this
like
is actually not that bad. I've read much worse than this. I've read like boobs, and I'm like, okay,
that's it,
like,
right?
Like yeah, Megan,
a lot
boobs.
Of times, a lot of times it's like hot but doesn't know it, right? It's like you know,
like
nerdy but cool. It's like a guy's fantasy version of a girl.
Yeah,
right? I mean,
yeah.
It is. It's like their projection of like the coolest girl ever, like into D&D, but like super hot, you know, or whatever. Like it's just
doesn't
so funny.
Exist.
Like and so yes, this was we read it again. What was it again? Sorry, it's in the notes.
Pretty but in a quiet way.
Pretty but in a quiet way. So that's
which,
Lucy.
You know what? I want to know more. What a mystery. What a mystery. And
but
this
I
girl.
Too, I too read that description and was like, that is so classic horror movie script.
It is in a way that I celebrate, I'm going to be honest with you, but it is worth pointing out, you know, critically.
Yes.
Yeah, so she's our new final girl. I believe she works at Smith's Grove to support her deadbeat boyfriend, Brad.
Such a deadbeat.
She seems like a good gal. How do we feel about her?
No, I mean they do a nice job, pretty right off the bat, right of establishing her. You know, she has this absent boyfriend, doesn't return her texts. Obviously, he's a bit of a jerk. She's got the you know, the sort of, what's the word that, you know, the, not precocious, with, you know, the roommate who's, you know, just more like laid back or what have you. And,
right.
and like, oh, don't worry about it, girl. And, you know, Lucy's, you know, all, you know, uptight or whatever. And mm-hmm. so they establish her and her, you know, her little world. And then she obviously, lucky for us as readers, yep. works at Smith's Grove.
Yes,
so she's got to get a ride to work because that jerk Brad's not taking her. So the roommate gives her a ride to Smith's Grove. And what was funny, though, I mean, it does strain credulity where she's like, oh, I totally forgot the execution was tonight.
Oops. That would be
like,
me.
Wait a minute.
That would be me. And I'm like, oh, my God, Michael Myers dies tonight.
Oh,
I totally forgot
tonight.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I forgot to put it on my phone.
Shit,
oh, my God.
I didn't put it on my Google Calendar.
Yeah, exactly.
I got the PST wrong. Okay, I have an idea for this. So if I put you on the spot, I apologize. But like, who would play her today?
Okay, it, like, it's funny.
Blue sky. Because I have someone in mind, but I want to know what you think.
My significant other, my girlfriend, is a casting director. And right before we started this, I sat here, right where I'm sitting. And she was sitting on the other side of my ear. I'm like, because, you know, I was trying to think of that. There's actually a bunch of names I could say. Because like, there was actresses that read for every one of these movies that I did, right? To be honest with you, I just don't want to mention their names because it's not like insulting and it's not, it would just be funny if they're like, who's this guy dropping my name on a podcast? You know, but no, there was definitely like a group of great young actresses who would just read all the time for these movies in a good way, right? You're like, oh, great. They're going to be, so I'd rather just hear your name. I don't want to like drop anybody's name and, and have them go, who the fuck is this guy?
You know what?
Should have been in Halloween 9 20 years ago. I don't know. I just feel like it might not be.
You're lucky because I have my Development Hell hat on today, not my
good.
Dread Central hat on, so I won't press you. But if I had my Dread Central hat on, you'd be in danger. So, okay. So I was picturing, and this might be a little reductive, but hear me out.
Go ahead.
A Florence Pugh type, like a la Midsummer.
Yeah.
You know, tragic, but yeah, very tragic. You know, pretty in a quiet way.
Yep.
You know, capable, but like kind of pissed off.
Yeah. And Florence like set the template for, you know, today's modern heroine. I mean, Midsummer performance alone is like one of the best. Not final girl. I mean, she actually is an interesting final girl in that movie because
she's
like happy to stay where she is.
Yeah.
I agree. So it's somebody, an actress that would have those qualities, but could also handle the kind of, you know, could carry the movie, right? Could really be the lead of the film and not just sort of be, you know,
boring,
window dressing.
Wallflower.
Yeah. Just wallpaper or something. Right.
So,
at the time, you would have gotten somebody like quality like that, you know, and there's like five or six people that we thought of. They're like, oh yeah. So, and they're all still working. But again, I don't know. I wouldn't want to just start dropping their names without their permission. There's some really good, there would have been some really great choices for that for sure. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
I mean, like what's so great is you look back at H2O and like Michelle Williams is in that movie, right? It's like a
Oscar
multiple
winner.
Oscar, you know, he had multiple nominations. And
oh my God, two Oscar winners in that movie now. Jamie Lee Curtis.
H2O. Oh, and Jamie Lee. Holy nice call.
Yeah.
Nice pull, dude. Yes.
Yeah.
Two Academy Award winners in H2O. I love that. Very cool.
Yeah. I don't know if Janet Leigh had an Oscar. Probably not. So.
She was really good at Oscar recall. I don't know. She might have been nominated for Psycho. She might have been nominated for Psycho. We'll look. I could be told somebody right now is going, dude, shut up. She was not. Anyway.
And
go ahead.
You know what, Josh Hartnett, he's got a chance one day. You never know. One good movie.
What's funny is he always had that. He was in a lot of Dimension movies and he always had that same haircut.
That fucking weird haircut.
Which
I hear he insisted upon.
Kind of. Yeah, it just was his look, you know?
So weird, but I love it. There's some other characters I want to touch base on because I think that the characters in this film are pretty great. I think that they're pretty distinct and likable for the most part.
Janet Leigh was in fact nominated for an Oscar for Psycho.
Hell yeah. Okay, so we have two winners
I needed to know that.
Nominated.
Yeah,
that's
and a nominee. Sorry, I interrupted you. Please start again.
No, that's... And what was that kid in? The guy that plays the nerdy boyfriend. Wasn't he in something good too?
What, in H2O?
Yeah.
Hahnbird was in The Ice Storm, the Ang Lee movie.
Oh, that's such a good movie.
He just comes from that movie, I believe, The Ice Storm, yeah.
I think he was in Jumanji also. Or fuck, something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, because yeah, I think, yeah, yes. And let's look that up too. This is why I love having
I really celebrate it when a nerd, like, gets to fuck in a movie. I like really think that's great.
Exactly, right? I mean, yeah. they deserve love too,
of
you
course.
Know?
Of course. Of course.
So, yeah, it was in The Ice Storm and Jumanji, correct.
Other characters in this, we've got Regina, who I believe is the head nurse, who in my mind I was picturing Octavia Spencer energy. Yep. We've got
or Regina King, and I know that's an easy
yes, she'd be
that's
great.
An easy assumption because her name is Regina, but immediately
no, they both be great.
It reminded me a lot of the nurse in Halloween 2, which I cannot remember her name, and I just watched it last night.
The cutie blonde one.
No, she gets bled out.
Oh,
the head nurse.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some same, nasty deaths in that.
Same character. Because again, I was always trying, when I read this, I was trying to look for like Easter or allusions to the previous film. So I didn't know if that was on purpose to make a kind of a similar character.
Oh,
so,
interesting. We have these security guards, one named Sam Smith, which I find very funny.
I thought that was funny too. Yeah.
Queer icon, Sam Smith.
Yeah, because Sam was not famous at that point, so they had no idea. Right, I thought that was really funny. Yeah.
And Bill Jenkins. So Sam Smith is like the younger security guard. I think he's in the late 20s. He's nervous. And there's Bill Jenkins, who's in his like 50s, and he sort of knows what's going on.
So two things there. One,
yeah,
I love that it's Sam's first night, this like shit Sam. Show of an evening where it's like they're executing the most notorious, you know, serial killer. And he's like, hey, it's my first night. And Sam acts as the cipher in that scene, right? Meaning he's the person that doesn't know anything. You know what I mean? So like,
yeah, totally.
Everybody tells him, you know, and by association, the audience, what all this means. Because he's the one who's like, what does that mean? Who's Michael Myers? What is this? So like,
and it's
he's the window for the audience to, for all this exposition.
And he's so tragic because, spoiler alert, he does die. Right before he dies, like, he's sort of having a panic attack and someone's like, do you think you die here? Like, is that what you think? He's like, no, like I see my kids and like, and then boof, he's like fully dead.
Wasn't that kind of awesome though?
Oh,
I was like,
it was great.
They're like, come on, you can do it. We're going to make it. He's like, yes.
I'm going to make it.
He just gets fucking off right in that moment.
Not,
it was great.
He did not make it. There's Bill Jenkins, I think the older guy, but the character that I'm so excited to talk about, and what an amazing name. Dr. Phineas Crane. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Dr. Phineas Crane?
Clearly the Loomis substitute, right? To the point, and it's another callback. When Crane starts talking, he says, not seeing the cage, seeing through the cage. Like he has Loomis's exact cadence, you know, evil, something to the effect of like evil has come to our hospital tonight. I mean, he really, really embodies the Loomis portion of this. So no, great name. I forgot about that name. I read it. I was like, oh my God, what a great movie name. And just basically is the Loomis substitute, but with a little bit of not mad scientist, right? Because, you know, but he's almost akin also to, and I thought a lot about this movie reading the script. He's akin to like Tommy Lee Jones's warden in Natural Born Killers. Like a portion of this movie reminds me a lot of like the last 30 minutes of Natural Born Killers, where like everybody's running around the asylum and it's fucking insane.
That's true.
The inmates, it just kind of reminded me of the chaos of that last 30 minutes of Natural Born Killers. Anyway, but Crane is
reading
like
him different.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah.
No, Crane is, he's just like, he can't mess this up. He clearly cannot fuck up the execution of Michael Myers. You know, of course he does, but he's a little bit Loomis and a little bit, hard-ass warden, I guess.
I was picturing him a little different. I was picturing him, like, kind of queer. Like, have you ever seen Bride of Frankenstein?
Dr. Pistorius, isn't that his name?
Yeah, guy. That queer as hell guy. Yeah. That gay
or almost like
guy.
Almost like Udo Kier, maybe, or something? Yeah.
Yes. Or, like, maybe the doctor from the Human Centipede energy. Like a weird German guy.
That's a much better way to go.
What I was picturing.
That's fucking great because Pretorius, and by the way, I mean, I love this that subversive nature of Bride of Frankenstein for the 30s. And it really is a very It has
gay as hell.
Exactly. It's made by a gay film and out at the time, gay filmmaker,
which
amazing,
is nuts.
Right? And
yeah.
You look at it now and you're like, oh my God, I love that what they were getting away with and saying at this time when it, you know, yeah. Interpretation of it. That's great.
We also have a documentary crew who are fun.
Yes.
So there's a documentary crew there filming a documentary called The Life and Death of Michael Myers. And presumably, I believe they're there to sort of be witness to his death.
Yes.
And there's three characters here. We've got the director, a young director named Tyler Johnson. We have his cameraman, Jared. And we have a bit of a throwaway girly, Evie. On sound.
Right. Yep.
What'd you think of these three?
Clearly, it's such an early 2000s, you know, kind of token thing where you have to have
the boobs.
Well, no. Meaning like the the boobs. No, yeah. Meaning like the reality crew. It's like part
yes.
a reality show, part Blair Witch, as I think we had talked about. Like, you know, you just had to have some element, you know. I mean, right, Resurrection had the, you know, early version of a streaming, you know, a live streaming event. So this was just a version of that, right, where you had to have some element that was part of the zeitgeist at the time, which is to say, you know, a doc crew or a reality crew, whatever it is, right, some other medium to get in there and it ups the body count.
Was it like mandated? Like, did they have to bring in that Blair Witch element because of how successful
that
was?
No, I mean, it was almost like a need, like a involuntary reflex back then. Some element of the script had to involve, you know, something of that nature.
Yep. It's funny because we had our Blair Witch Project moment and then it kind of disappeared. And then after Paranormal Activity, it came back and it never left found footage horror. And now it's like a bona fide subgenre. People don't complain about it. It's like respected.
Yep.
But at the time it wasn't a subgenre. I think it was more of like, what's the word where it's like you sell something.
A marketing tool or
something like that.
And so I wasn't surprised to see it in there. I was like, oh, right. You know, the kind of stock reality camera crew or what have you at the time, the arrogant filmmaker who has to make his masterpiece documentary. And
25 year old.
It was fine. It was, it was body count and it gave Crane the opportunity for some exposition to them and they got to ask him questions. So it was another way to kind of set the stage for the movie, you know, without having to beat the audience over the head with it.
One of my favorite elements of the script and makes it pretty unique in the canon of Michael Myers movies is they bring in this totally new element, which is the psychopaths.
Yes.
So as we mentioned in the story, the asylum loses power and all of the inmates are free. But before that happens, we learn about two of the more sort of nefarious psychopaths. We have one, Jake Gracie, a necrophile who, let's see if I can get this right, would cut off portions of his face skin and then bury. Can you help me out? What the fuck?
Yeah, he would cut off pieces of his skin from his face and then bury his victims with it. So what that did is that gave his face, you know, he had this scarred visage, right? It was like this scar tissue and he was like missing pieces of his face. So that was more of a
visual. Was he killing people and then fucking them or was he just finding dead people?
Well, necrophilia. Oh, right. Okay. So I don't know if
was killing them and then.
I would say he was killing them and then, that would be his pathology in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, Gracie and Ludlow. Who I think was more just a hulking killer. Refined nature of the Gracie kills. Just kidding.
But what I liked about Ludlow is that he had portraits of his victims tattooed all over him, which is like pretty wild. Do you think Ludlow, is there any chance that was a Stephen King reference, a Pet Sematary reference?
That's a good question. I don't know. I actually don't know the best. It is spelled differently, and I was trying to see if there was any things like that, character names, that were not in this one. I think in the other one. Sorry, but yes. So we have these two other psychos, and
they're fun.
They are. I wonder, though, in reading it yesterday, I was like, man, is it? And we'll get to it when they really have their moments. But like, I was like, did it take away from Michael? You felt like it added, right? I mean, I felt like it took the focus away from Michael, but it also added a lot of craziness to the script.
I think both points are valid. I think that, right. Yeah, they do take away from Michael, but it does kind of switch up the formula in a way that we've never seen before, like having there be other dangers, like other antagonists.
It reminded me of like King Kong, right, where there's like Kong is on the island, but there's dinosaurs or, you know, spiders, giant snakes, right, whatever it is, right? It just when he faces them down at the end, that's what it reminded me of, is Kong killing the other dinosaurs on the island and stuff.
I like that a lot. I will say, I think Jake Gracie, like, there's potential there that maybe wasn't totally met.
100%. 100%.
Maybe even with both of them.
Yes.
Fun idea, though. But, yeah, it did become, like, set pieces of just people.
It did. Because then, like, even after he escapes, Gracie starts converting people immediately. Like,
so fast.
People start to peeling their skin off their face.
Yeah, because he's a cult leader, too.
Right, he's got obviously like a Manson-esque like cult leader. So I'm like, oh, he's already converting people within like 2 minutes. But again, I'm like, but in moments of reading it, I'm like, what the hell does this have to do with anything, though? And again, it's not. It's a constructive note. I didn't dislike it, but it just feels like it's a different movie. It feels like it's in another movie. But yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
I mean, it's still better than Ends. So
it's true. I thought you were going to say Resurrection.
No.
We'll talk about Ends another time. Yeah.
So those are sort of, I think, our characters.
Our main characters. Yes.
Yeah. These are who we're dealing with. And then as, you know, this hospital goes into lockdown, which did give me a House on Haunted Hill vibe in a way that I liked, because I love that
one
movie.
Other callback was when they look out the window, the film crew sees the inmates running around. She says, since when did they let them? There's an exact line from the original,
from Halloween.
Yeah.
What's was the it line?
Since when did they let them wander around? So he writes the exact same line. Again, I have a whole list of callbacks here we'll get to, but yes, I remember
that was
line.
Familiar. Yes. Of course, that's cool. It's a scary one.
It is. It's a great line. It's a great line from the original. The power goes out, of course, inevitably, and Michael, you know, the execution goes horribly awry. And that's really where the concept kicks in, right? Now they're all trapped in there together.
And
they have to survive the night, as they always say. So, yeah. And at that point, I think they've set everybody up pretty well. And then you get right into the main concept. And one thing I will say, and again, Patrick Melton and Marcus Dunson mentioned this on their episode. It really was, I was talking earlier about the kind of mandates. It really was important to the folks at the top of the chain on at Dimension to have that execution scene. Like it was, Patrick and Marcus spoke about it, but they really wanted that on the poster. They wanted Michael Myers in an electric chair. That was a big thing. We must have the scene where he almost, you know, where he's about to get electrocuted. The execution of Michael Myers was really something they wanted to lean into. I don't know.
Was it like just a personal thing? Like someone just really wanted it?
If they couldn't see the poster, they didn't want to make the movie. It really is that simple. Like,
so reductive.
They reverse engineered it to be like, all right, they'd hear a pitch and be like, okay, great. Yeah, but what's the poster? And then they come up with a poster and like, oh, okay. Now I know how to sell the movie. Let's go make it. Right. So they thought that image of Michael in a electric chair would be worthwhile. So that's why it's in there, is my point. That was one of the mandates. Again, it's always so about Smith's Grove, and in this case, it was about the execution.
Michael in electric chair. It's just so bonkers, but I like it. I think someone that we sort of forgot to mention is, you were talking about how they wanted to bring back some legacy characters.
Yes.
And the legacy, so do you want to sort of let us know what the other legacy character who?
So Sheriff Lee Brackett is back in this film, which I thought was awesome. I remember at the time everybody was really high on the idea of bringing back Charles Cyphers as Sheriff Brackett. And at the time, his look, you know, he had aged a bit, obviously, in between the movies. And his look, he looked like Donald Pleasance. He had like this goatee, you know, it was like kind of salt and pepper goatee. And we saw a picture of him, like, oh, and he even looks like kind of the new Loomis. So I thought bringing him back was a great idea. I was super excited about that. Side note, you should look up who Lee Brackett really was. I don't know if you're familiar with Lee Brackett. She's a famous screenwriter, and she wrote science fiction novels. She's like a pioneering writer in science fiction, and she wrote Empire Strikes Back, crazy. So her name is Lee Brackett. You should look her up.
I will.
So it was really great. But my problem is, Josh, he is horribly underused in this movie. He gets nothing to do. Again, spoiler for a movie that you'll never see. He tries to kill Michael, and they throw him in a cell, and he just sits in a cell the rest of the movie. I mean, it's just, he doesn't get any catharsis. He doesn't get to kill Michael or anything. Like, you want him to almost be the Jamie Lee of this movie, where he gets to, you know, confront him and, you know, whatever, pull a gun on him, whatever he's going to do, or, you know, stab him and they stab each other, whatever it is, right?
Something.
Moment. And so I was very excited for Sheriff Brackett to come back, but I just didn't think he was properly utilized in this script. But again, awesome idea. Was really excited by that.
Yeah, I would have liked to see them do more with him. He comes, he's present at the execution. I think he like kind of has like a bit of a breakdown.
Yes.
Pulls out his gun and is going to kill Michael, and then throw him aside.
They just put him in a cell, which, by the way, you can't just throw somebody in a cell.
I know. Like, and there
was, I was like, is that legal? You just threw him in a padded room, you know? Like, wait a second. Due process here? Like, he just is in the rest of the movie, and he gets stabbed in the eyes, which I thought was a callback to Halloween 2, where she shoots Jason in the eyes and he's bleeding from his eyes. Again, I just was seeing all of these callbacks in the script. But yes, I love Sheriff Lee Brackett coming back, but no, he didn't do much at all, unfortunately, in the script.
I want to talk a little bit about the violence in this script.
Yeah.
I noticed a lot of instances of heads being crushed and throats being slashed and bodies being strung up among, you know, the frozen meat. What are some of the violent moments that stood out to you?
I did like when Gracie gets his head crushed. It reminded me of Rick in Friday 13th 3.
Oh, yeah.
That great kill. And it was Gracie, you know, so Gracie had to go out in some super gory, painful way.
Of course.
So I loved when Michael just crushes his friggin' head. I thought that was hilarious. Chang, the doctor, the medical examiner, had to find out he's drunk. And I'm like, what a horrible moment to pick to get drunk.
Comically takes a comic swig of vodka. I was like, what is a comical swig of vodka?
Just, he's drunk, so then he doesn't believe in, everybody, you know, that client, I think he thinks it's everything's a joke, and then somebody's under, whatever it is, somebody's like under a sheet, I think, and so he just has that comic relief moment where he's drunk. I'm like, what a terrible time to get drunk. His death is, and the nurse hanging frozen in the freezer with blood coming out of her, like Carbone and Goodfellas.
Was that an off-screen death? Did we see her die on screen?
Yes.
Okay.
I had to go back and look because I was like, wait a minute, did we see her die off screen? But a lot of them are also pretty standard butcher knife kills. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of them are pretty down the road Michael Myers stuff.
Which I like. You know,
Instrument of choice. Yeah, that's his weapon of choice. And every time they try to get too creative with it, I'm like, I feel like they're falling off track a little bit. But no, a lot of violent kills. And again, that's part of the mayhem of like the prison riot-esque nature of it, you know?
And it's the other guys that are almost more grotesque. Like the other two psychos are a little bit more like nastier with like the skin peeling stuff.
But that's what I mean. So then it makes Michael seem like the good guy.
A little bit. And maybe he is.
Saves Lucy from imminent death from both of them. I'm like, well, now you're
save Lucy.
Making him a nice guy, you know? So that's why I think like they take away from him, which is fine. But like, they're good characters and good plot devices. But I'm like, now Michael seems like a nice guy by saving her life.
Maybe he is.
Maybe. Maybe he's misunderstood all these years. Who knows?
I mean, I'm into it. Showdown. It gets a little confusing at the end. So let's talk a little bit about the finale, like the mm-hmm. third act. Mm-hmm. How, in your opinion, does this script, what's going on in our third act?
It's always so funny how the third act of horror movies is always densely written because there's no dialogue. It's always people, like we call it sneak and creep.
Okay.
It's always people just fighting and running down the halls and, you know, fighting off killers. And it just was like, you get into that end and they're all just running around and there's like confrontations and all that. In the very, very end, I thought it was odd that they let her go home. Right. Like, doesn't Lucy go home at the end? Like, she's gone through this horrible idea.
I think that's
ordeal.
Where the final confrontation is. It's like in her house.
And the cops are like, get out of here. You know, go home. She's home in time for trick-or-treating. Like,
I know, which is so funny. This all happens really fast.
Really fast. It's like, well, I did notice that. So the movie really does have a real-time feel to it.
I mean, that's cool.
Sorry. I just messed up my headphones here. not on purpose, but that's what I thought. I'm like, oh, if she's home in time for trick-or-treating, the whole movie took place basically in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? While all hell broke loose at the asylum. So, yeah, I just thought that was funny that they let her go. I mean, I would think that she'd be brought to the station and, yeah, question her or whatever it is, right? So I didn't think it needed to go to her house. I think he could have ended it, had some confrontation at the asylum.
Doesn't someone drive a car into her house?
Yes.
Who? What's going on?
I made a note of that.
Was it the doctor?
It was, because Crane and her are the two
survivors.
Yeah. Yeah. So Crane drives the house in and kills him. And then when they go to look, of course, Michael's gone. You know, the classic Halloween beat where he's dead and then you look down and he's gone.
Does he need to break her house? Does he need to do that? That feels unnecessary.
I'd be like, I rent this place, man. I don't own this house. What am I going to say to my landlord?
He's like, he's escaped. although the last moment I do kind of like, which is Michael gets away and Lucy and Crane are just like, peering out over Halloween night as trick-or-treaters are doing their thing. And they're just like, oh, shit. Yep. I guess we're fucked. And then we hear the Halloween theme song.
Yep. So, I mean, look, they're overall, like, in spite of some of the constructive criticism we just doled out, like,
of course.
I thought this was solid, right? It was conceptually solid. It felt Halloween-y.
Totally.
In the opening, they establish that it's Halloween night. So you get all those great trappings and the establishment of the world, and it feels Halloweenish and feels autumnal, all those great things. Because then you're in the asylum for most of the movie. And at the end, he's gone, right? And you can hear the music in your head kick in when they realize he's escaped from the car accident. So no, it felt like a Halloween movie to me. And it did. And it just felt contained. The contained is a word we use way too much, and especially in genre filmmaking, because everything's got to be in like one place. But yeah, it was really contained. It was a high concept. It fit in with the mythology, right? Which is to say, it took place at Smith's Grove. You know, it wasn't out of canon, right? It wasn't like, again, he's not in space. He's not at a military base or whatever. You know, all these things we were talking about earlier. But it just felt like it existed in that universe. And it felt like I got a Halloween feeling from it. It felt like a Halloween film to me.
I think in a lot of ways it's tighter, more concise than a lot of Halloween movies that we've ever gotten. Agreed. I think it's tighter and more concise than the last three.
Yep.
It's certainly more fun tonally than anything we've had in the last 20 years.
Yep.
So
that's what I say. It felt tight. The concept felt just very clean. Hang on. Let me get before because I think we might switch to the other one in a minute. Mm-hmm. So no, the other callbacks in Asylum, he kills a German Shepherd.
Oh yeah.
Like he did in the first movie. Sad. Jenkins slips in a puddle of blood, like Jimmy did in Halloween 2.
Yep.
At one point, that's what Chang was seeing. I think it was the Chang scene when he's drunk. There's somebody in a ghost sheet, right? The blood from Brackett's eyes. At one point, a girl says, I think Evie says, see anything you like PJ Souls did in the first movie when she, you know, like bares her body or whatever. And then, when they're looking through Michael's files, and by the way, old Michael Myers files appear in all these scripts, as you probably know. It's always about looking at old files. They mentioned that they see the words Thorn and Samhain in those files.
Oh, shit.
It just mentions like, but one device I think that I really liked was listening to the old tapes. They do this really well in an old, obscure, unfortunately obscure horror movie called Session 9 from like 2002.
I love really, Session 9.
Yeah. So, and they, right where the guy, and I actually ended up coincidentally sitting next to those guys the next night, the guys that made that movie at a screening. And I was like, oh my God, I loved your movie. Still friendly with him. So, but I love that those scenes of him listening to those tapes, like the voices are really creepy and slowed down. So when I read Asylum and they're listening to the old Michael tapes, I thought that was a good, that could be a cool opportunity for some creep there, you know, some creepiness there where those tapes sound slowed or damaged in some way. I thought that was kind of neat. And you have to get a Donald Pleasance in person.
I was going
to
say, obviously. We got Loomis.
Yeah. You get a little taste of Loomis in there, but it just felt, it did. It felt like a Halloween movie to me in ways that other, some of these scripts that we might discuss later, some do, some don't, but this one did.
Totally. Know, sure. And it doesn't take itself, I don't know if this is on purpose, but it doesn't seem to take itself seriously in a way that I don't think these movies should.
It's
agreed. A blast to
read. Yeah, it did not take itself seriously. And again, it revered the earlier movies and just leaned into a pretty straightforward concept. They're all trapped in Smith's Grove. mm-hmm. with Michael Myers. I mean, it's the elevator pitch. That's it. I mean, it's a really simple idea.
Well, speaking of being trapped in Smith's Groves with Michael Myers, why don't we jump ship a little bit into the other sort of potential Halloween 9, which is Halloween Retribution.
Yes.
Now, listeners of this podcast are familiar with it. We did an episode on Retribution on our last Halloween is Canceled, but we didn't have, you know, the development exec with us at the time. So I think it might be a good opportunity for me to pick your brains just a little bit about this other iteration of Halloween 9 and, you know, how it might kind of parallel what we were seeing in Asylum.
Yeah. So it's funny. You talked about this script. It was the same one.
Yeah.
I always felt like there was another script out there called Retribution, but I remember as soon as I started reading it, I remembered it. And I don't know if I have as much sort of direct knowledge of it, but I do remember this script. This one, let's see, I had some notes on this one as well.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, then someone's named Dr. Hill, like Deborah Hill. I thought that was funny.
I like that, but it's a man.
One of the other callbacks was when Freddie yells at the car, it stops. Like she does in the first movie. She goes, hey, creep, speed kills. And, you know,
First of all,
they mentioned the town of Bethesda, which is where I grew up. I thought that was funny. It's in Maryland. They leaned into the idea of outlawing Halloween, which we've seen in other Halloween movies where there's a curfew. He's watching old John Carpenter movies in one scene. I think the security guard. And then you mentioned this brilliantly in the discussion or notes we had. She makes herself look like Judith Myers, which is a direct callback to Friday the 13th Part 2, which I just watched on Friday night.
Do you think they did that on purpose?
I don't know. I could not say for sure. But like, if it's not on purpose, it is either subconscious or consciously.
It's cool though.
I thought that was great. I thought that was great. But it's a really twisted though. You know, she's like, she's like, you know, Michael, you're the only, whatever. Like, there's obviously a psychosexual thing, allure that she's trying to convey.
That's what it's all about, kind of, here.
It is. Like, they do delve a little bit into that sort of pathology for Michael, right? The possessiveness of his sister and all that. But overall, this one felt, again, it has a clean concept, a bunch of kids at Smith's Grove, the abandoned Smith's Grove in this version. It's not in use anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But this felt like a little more stock, right? Meaning like it just had a bunch of kind of dopey archetypal kids. You know, we used to call it six kids in a van with a joint. Like,
yep.
It's just, you know, felt a little more straightforward in that way. They did bring Freddy back, right? So again, that's what I'm saying. So all these scripts involve either Smith's Grove Smith's Grove and Freddy, right? And a Freddy cameo and he gets killed. John Tate coming back, I remember at the time not being super crazy about that because I knew Josh would never come back.
No.
And I just never liked three different people playing like Tommy Jarvis, right? In Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
It's took weird. Off because it's three different people in my mind. I mean, they're all good. I mean, well, forget about five, but
I mean, he was hot though in five, so
he was like jacked,
dude. Yeah, exactly.
So, I was like, Tommy Jarvis works out. I just didn't love the idea of recasting someone else as John Tate, and she's not that well known of a character, right? Like, I don't think people are going, oh my god, they brought back John Tate, you know. I don't know if I agree with that.
I was excited by it.
Really? You dug that, huh?
Well, he's got something. His mom's dead.
Yes.
He's a blood relative. And blood is thicker than water, as Halloween H2O reminded us.
Indeed.
There's something about him maybe like becoming the new shape, which I liked, but I know audiences hate. Like, audiences do not want the villain to become a new, like, Halloween. They don't want a Friday the 13th Part 5 again.
You're right.
I'm not against it, but...
And they ended the final chapter with, like, Corey Feldman opening his eyes at the camera, and you think that's... I remember at the time being like, ooh, Tommy's the new Jason.
Halloween 4? I did that at the end, too.
Yes, they did that with Jamie Lloyd. You're absolutely right. So, I don't know. For me, again, this is revisiting it, and at the time, maybe I liked that. I don't know. Yeah, I was just like, I don't know, John Tate, he wasn't as iconic, let's say, as Lee Brackett, but Lee Brackett had, you know, whatever it was, 20-some years to age well at that point as a character.
And was in a couple of movies.
They did bring Lee Brackett back in this one again, and he got more to do. Like, he, although at the end, I think he kind of...
He was better.
He was better, but I still think John got more of that moment with Michael at the end there. I don't know if... I can't remember. I had it in my notes, I think, where... I think Lee at least like shoots at him, or, you know, he has some.
It's sad moments. In this one. Yeah, there's more of a tragedy in this one.
Yeah, he's like a broken down drunk, you know.
Yes.
and they all like don't believe him, and they're like, "You kind of do this every year, Lee." Like,
which
I'm not laughing at. I mean,
I think it's cool. I think it's cool. This guy sounds cool to me. But yeah, they did Brackett better. I think Brackett was treated with a little more
care and respect. Yes. Agree with that. But I don't like, and again, I think you mentioned this in one of our previous conversations or notes, I didn't like that it was snowing. It's like, this one didn't feel like a Halloween movie to me because it's all in the snow. It just didn't, this one just did not. I don't know why.
You obviously did not grow up in Canada.
Clearly, no. I mean, it snowed in Maryland where I grew up, but no, yeah, not
on
nearly
Halloween?
As bad as, yeah.
Every 20 years on Halloween, we'll get a little snow.
Not on Halloween. No, you got me there. But no, there's something about this one. And again, I don't think it was as fun of a read for me as a reread, I should say, as Asylum. Mm-hmm. Had some nice moments, had some nice sequences. Again, really clean concept. Just kids, you know, spending the night in Smith's Grove. Boom. Right. So, and again, a lot of archetypes, the nice, sweet main final girl and her like, you know, crazy best friend and all those archetypes.
The brother.
Yeah. So, but again, I just, the snow thing really threw me off. It really did.
That's fair. It has to be
autumnal. Yeah, it's got to be the leaves and the, you know, and all that kind of stuff. Sorry.
But Jason is at his core summertime sadness, but we want to see him in the snow.
This is true. And I always say that to people because they go, I like watching Friday the 13th around Halloween time, which I do as well. But I'm like, but technically it's a summer movie.
They take place
in the summer. Those are summer. You should watch them in like August. That's the best time to watch a Friday the 13th movie.
Yes. But Halloween is more specifically a very specific
super
vibe.
It's got a vibe, right? It has to feel like Haddonfield. Has to feel, you know, like Crystal Lake changed so much over the course of those movies because they'd shot them in different states over the course of however many movies.
And Canada.
And they did. You're absolutely right.
Oh, yeah.
They did. We spoke about that too. But yeah, it's funny. It's really interesting how I don't really have nearly as much to say about Retribution. What were some of your thoughts on Retribution?
I'm with you. I think Retribution it's a little darker.
Yes.
It's a little scarier.
Yes.
But it's a little less fun. Like, these characters are not as distinct or archetypal as what we were dealing with in Asylum. And I really liked that. Although I have to say, I liked the ending. There's this finale where we have John Tate in like the ice going underwater with Michael Myers, and you don't know who's going to come back out.
I did like that. Yes.
The
finale
is kind of fun.
Yeah.
And he comes out with the devil's eyes at the end.
Yep.
But I know audiences would be pissed about that if he actually got a movie where he was the killer. So I would like to see a Halloween legacy film with that character as the lead.
As John Tate, you mean?
Yeah, I think that'd be fun. But he couldn't be the killer.
But like, in the sense that it hits some of those same beats as Asylum, you know, vis-a-vis like bringing Freddy back. So I just think some of the execution of those same beats was just better in Asylum. And it just, Asylum just felt more like a movie that would be made, right? Retribution just, again, it wasn't bad. It just felt really dark. Yeah, I didn't know any of the kids from the other, right? They all just were kind of like goofball. Not, you know, I mean, there was like, am I to believe that kid Noah, he doesn't speak, had some sort of like psychic connection to my, there was like a thing where he was like sensed him or something. You know what I mean? Like, and I think I misread that, but.
No, I think you're right.
There wasn't, you know, not everybody was totally indistinct. There were some memorable characters. Again, I read Asylum and was like, oh my gosh, I completely remember this. I would have loved to have made this movie. Retribution was like solid, you know, work, solid craftsmanship, but, you know, just
it's
didn't
not
grab me.
There. You know what? You were talking about all the references in Asylum, and I think it's pretty clear when reading Retribution that it doesn't have the same reverence for the franchise.
That's a good point. And maybe that's one of the things that was the disconnect, right? It didn't feel like, it doesn't mean you have to know the series really well to write one, but it helps.
I think so.
I like it. You know, I personally prefer that, but yeah, it just didn't feel like there was many callbacks, and it just felt like a gloomier
It's
I don't mean that in a good way. It's not. I don't mean that like gloomy and kind of like ugh, kind of a bummer of a movie way.
Yeah, it's not like moody in its vibe, but it is a little more. It's a little more like downtrodden. But I will say, if you get it, if anyone out there gets a chance to read it, definitely worth a peek.
Correct.
For Halloween fans, like
yes,
it's yeah, it's like a treat to be able to see like this alternative.
It is cool. Again, it was really fun to revisit those. And I totally talked a little bit about it for Taking Shape, too, a few years back for that book. But really getting it, diving back in and rereading them and making notes on them again. It was a huge treat, Josh. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that because it was really fun to revisit those.
Yeah, this was an absolute blast today, which thank God it worked out because, spoiler alert, we might be seeing you again in the very near future.
I won't add to that, but yes, it might just might be, and it could be. I have plenty to say about maybe another one as well. So a little teaser there for the audience for sure.
Yes, yes. When our next miniseries Dracula 2000 is canceled. So if we're going to jump into conclusions, I have a couple questions for you.
Yes.
Would we have wanted to see Asylum made? Was it the right choice to reboot the franchise with Zombie? Or do we think this would have been the better route?
Okay. Multiple answers to that question. One, yes, I would have loved to have seen Asylum get made. Like 100%. And I thought that at the time. And I really felt that rereading it this weekend. However, I do think remaking it or just rebooting it with Rob's movie was the way to go. And I'll tell you why. And I left a mention right before they sort of made that decision. But I can tell you the thinking was just like, we had looked under every rock or, you know, shaken every tree and just really looked from a million different directions, a million different perspectives on how to do another Halloween movie. And it just wasn't compelling enough, I think, to the powers that be. And again, as a fan and as a horror geek, I was like, man, Brackett coming back. And, you know, I just don't think it was the right time for that. I think they eventually did it in Kills. And I love seeing all like a lot of this stuff ended up. And I'm not saying we had anything to do with that, but I'm saying a lot of this stuff ended up happening in the new trilogy, the recent trilogy. And I'm like, oh, good. I'm glad it finally came to be. But like at the time, I just don't think the decision makers were just felt like that was a compelling enough new movie or a compelling enough next step or new direction or whatever. And I think it was the right decision. If I was sitting in that room and then somebody said, you know what, man, let's just start at the beginning and remake it. I would say yay if I had a vote. So yeah, it was the right way to go. And I think Rob was the perfect choice because Carpenter's Halloween is, you know, it's got a low body count. It's bloodless. Right. It's a very non-violent movie in a way, and comparatively speaking, and it doesn't explain Michael at all. Right. So with Rob's, it's like you have to go with a completely different aesthetic. Right. Rob has like this like hellbilly thing. Right. Where everybody has like long, greasy hair and it's really violent. And Michael's like super angry and violent in that movie. So I thought it was interesting. Right. You weren't going to try to just remake Carpenter's movie at that time. You had to do something completely different with it. And I thought they did the right thing by giving it to Rob and letting him make his version of it. You know,
I think I agree with you. I'm not a fan necessarily of the zombie movies, but I think financially speaking, people don't care about Sheriff Brackett. You know, 2% of the people seeing these movies would care about that, especially in 2007.
Yep.
So I think to keep the franchise alive and to stir up interest, yeah, I do think they made the right choice.
100%. And that's what was so heartbreaking, right? Because, you know, Brackett and there's some other, we'll maybe get to that on the other one we're maybe talking about. Yeah, but the legacy thing at the time just wasn't clicking. You're right. No, at the end of the day, nobody cared and that was a bummer. But it was the right thing. I agree.
Do you think that there's a chance at all that we could see even aspects of these scripts ever get used?
That's a really awesome question. And I thought the exact same thing when I was reading them, or I asked myself that same question. Yes. I mean, the short answer to give you is yes, right? I would love, I'll be totally frank with you. Like I have some friends I'm working with. We've already started knocking on the door for how the hell to get involved with these TV cinematic universe.
Yeah.
And I, you know, again, total long shot, but we know a lot of the people involved, right? And all of these people I'm talking about, we've all worked on the Halloween franchise at some point or another. So, and I thought about that. I'm like, man, I was trying to figure out if they own these scripts or who owns these scripts and if you were allowed, because there's really neat sequences in all of these scripts. There's at least one or two scenes where I'm like, that's fucking cool. Man, it'd be so great to repurpose that for something else, right? Mm-hmm. So if they're trying to build out this whole cinematic universe with Halloween, there's a trove of stuff in these old scripts. So yes, to answer your question, I would love to see some of these old scenes or ideas or sequences show up in new material. Yeah.
Okay, you got to promise me I get Dangertainment 8 episodes on Peacock, though. You have to promise me.
I really do love that idea. It's so funny. Who knows, man? I think that's great.
Pitch it for me. Okay, so before I let you go, what are you up to these days? What are you working on? What's going on?
As mentioned, you know, we've all had to kind of sit on the sidelines, but we've all had a fairly quiet year in some ways with the strikes and everything. So I think it gave everybody a chance to, you know, put things together that maybe they weren't able to do so before, have the time to do. And, you know, it's kind of this time of like new ideas or new directions combined with the urgency of just really wanting to get back to work. Mm-hmm. And that idea of like, hey guys, we can't just sit here and do nothing forever. So that being said, I got to look at my desktop. I have like four projects, five that are almost are all genre. And as I alluded to earlier, I'm starting a new genre company with some great people that I cannot wait to talk to you about at some point. But literally, it's in its infancy. It's a little, you know, amoeba of an idea or an embryo of an idea. Sorry, I should say. But there's some really great people involved, and we already have like our first. Everybody kind of putting in at least one or two projects that we're already working on. It's grown into like a really cool little collection of movies to make. So I'm super stoked. This year's been rough with the strike, but I'm really excited about 2024. And there's two or three in particular are really cool little genre movies that I can't wait to make. So a lot. Again, I really cannot wait to talk about this company when the time is right. And you and I will talk all about it, my friend.
I'm psyched as hell, and I am rooting for you 100%. Where could you be found online if you want to be found? Do you use social media? Can people follow you?
I have a minimal social media footprint. I do have a Instagram account. My Instagram account is like the only, I don't have X/Twitter. I don't have, God, Facebook is just an awful place.
Hellscape.
It's just so much. Yeah, it's just
all it is.
Vitriol and political,
it's rough.
It is rough. Nicholas C. Phillips is my Instagram handle.
All right.
And it's a combo of I have a family, I have kids and all that, so yes, you have to see a lot of photos of my kids and all that, but I do post about work a lot, and I do have stuff that I finished before the strike that actually should be coming out. Actually, one of them is genre, cool. I did, like, there's things that I've coming out in the next few months, genre and non-genre, that I was working on before the strike. So something's getting released in the coming year, and then more than that getting made in the coming year. So I cover all that on my Instagram account, and you can find me there.
That's cool as hell. Thank you so much for joining me on this episode. This was a blast.
Thank you,
and
Josh.
I don't think this is the last of you. I think we'll see you again. I'm not sure, but that's my feeling. Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.